Music, among other things.
Music among other things.
Music among other things.
Hey everyone, I'm Sean.
And I'm Neil.
And welcome to Music Among Other Things, or MAOT for short, where we chat to musicians and creators about music and the worlds that orbit it. And we're starting today a little bit serene, because this is like, do you have the thing where you pick up a guitar and you have like one piece of music you always go to?
You're talking to me?
Yeah.
I thought you were just talking to space. Yes, I do. It's the Smiths. Please let me get what I want.
Oh, really?
Which drives my missus crazy.
So is that's the C it starts on, right?
Yeah. Good times.
Yeah. Can I always start with, today's guest, Villagers, the song Courage.
It's just spoiler alert.
It's like a nice little country sort of ditty thing.
It's beautiful.
But I always go for that. Yeah, so, I mean, we let the cat out of the bag, but, people would have seen the title of the episode anyway, but we got Connor O'Brien from Villagers on today, who we've bonded over a lot over the years, I'd say, Neil, as in...
Oh, I massively, feel like
We're always playing Villagers music when around your house and stuff, and we're chilling on the Sunday or the Saturday or whenever we're seeing each other.
His music fits so many different vibes and occasions, doesn't it? So...
Yeah,
it's kind of made us the friends and a host and co-host that we are today, I'd say.
Well, exactly. It's a bond, to say the least. But we're really excited to have Connor on. He's got a album coming out in August called Fever Dreams, which we've been lucky enough to hear, and we're going to get chatting to him about it in a bit. And it seems like it was recorded in quite a unique way. It was recorded... or put together a lot throughout lockdown last year. So I think it's going to be really interesting to talk to him about how that came together, whether he drove himself nuts making this record, because I mean, we all went a bit crazy working at our, you know, desks and stuff like that. So you sort of wonder what it's like with the creative process as well. And I think there's sort of like loads to get into, and because I guess you and me, Neil, have been fans for so long, we can sort of dive into some deep questions as well.
Yeah, and it's great. We've literally just a minute before recording bought tickets to a show in Manchester, so
exactly,
can't bloody wait for that.
We're gonna have a little MAOT road trip up to the Manchester, go see him live. But have you seen him live a couple of times, right?
I think we went to Cambridge, I want to say, actually, to see Villagers live. It was amazing, yeah, so good. Like we were talking about earlier, behind the scenes, it's just so, you can hear a pin drop at his gigs. It's so quiet and so relaxing, and it's a very different gig to one I've been to be honest.
Yeah, I think with that Art of Pretending to Swim record, the last one he brought out, he had a more electronic feel, some more upbeat songs, even though they did exist on the other ones. But I think particularly the material from his first couple of records is really one of those pin drop moments, like you say. Everybody in the audience is totally silent and listening to every bar, every breath he's taking, which must be quite intense as a performer. So I'm quite interested to see what that's like from his perspective, because it's sort of also one of those things when you're in the audience, you know, you don't know when to clap. You know when the song's like ending, you're like, I know it's ended, but am I just going to ruin the moment if I just start slapping my hands together?
I know, and I don't want to sound too fanboy, but yeah, Connor's one of those people that his voice just sounds so unique and incredible, but he could equally just make anything sound his own. Like, he could sing anything and make it his own.
I think there's a real like clarity to his voice as well, which is really refreshing. I think one of my favorite covers by him is the, you know, the Beatles In My Life cover. But that's a beautiful cover.
I don't know how he reaches that note, to be honest.
Yeah, it's sort of one of those things because at the end, like, you know, Lennon gets up there and you're like, is he going to go for it? Oh, yes, he did. Oh, yes, he did.
Because there's other covers I've seen, like, when I was watching it on YouTube, I think, recently, just different covers of that song. And I'm like, are they? Are they? It's like, in my life. And I'm like, oh, yeah, no. So lame. Yeah. Then Connor just absolutely owns it.
Yeah. It's so effortless for him, I think.
It is.
I think there was something a few years ago where Philip Schofield, some like early footage came out of him playing Joseph in Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. And you know that bit where he's like, and I know I will find, but he like gets a real, he hits a real flat note, but really goes for it at the same time. But it's
you gotta admire the effort.
I mean, yeah, fair play. I mean, I don't know. Can you do that in my life bit?
Go on, play me in, tune me in.
Oh no!
You do it first. You go first.
In my life, I love them all. Go on, right, you give it a go.
In my life, I love them all. Oh fucking hell! Jesus.
That's nice.
Let's edit that last bit.
All right, edit it out. Anyway, I think Connor's about to drop on, so let's get into it. Awesome, thanks so much for joining us. Are you?
Yeah,
in,
no worries. Good to see you again as well. I remember, yeah, we met a couple of times, didn't we?
Oh, we have. Yeah. I think we met. I think we met once at the, you were doing like the Mumford and Sons thing, and I think you were quite hungover that day, if I remember rightly.
Probably.
Yeah, and then I think I met you at like the Roundhouse or something like that. But
yes, that's yeah.
But yeah, good to see you again, man. What's the
four times
exactly? What's the vibe in Dublin right now? Are you in Dublin?
Yeah, in Dublin. It's kind of weird. It's like it's very sunny, but and everyone's out. But the case, it's kind of like with you guys, the cases are going up again, and it's all a bit like. Everyone's a little bit like, what the hell's going on? So, but everyone's kind of got their fingers in their ears and it's just out in the sun drinking and stuff. So,
yeah, exactly. So, we were looking at like what you've been up to in lockdown and stuff. We saw like you've been doing like night walks in Dublin and playing ping pong and everything like that. And I was wondering, like, what's the connection between musicians and playing ping pong? Because it seems like every musician plays ping pong or something, like all these big tour documentaries. I don't know if you've noticed that, or that's just something like I'm picking up.
I didn't know that was a thing. I'm perfectly happy with that.
Maybe it's a rite of passage when you've made it, you just, you know, naturally start playing ping pong, like Lady Gaga, Bob Marley, Christina Aguilera, all these others we've got.
Well, actually, funnily enough, the people that I play ping pong with, we call it Pang. We've got a little WhatsApp group called Pang, so we can just dive in and see if anyone's around. But nice. I think every single one of them is a musician or an engineer in music. So
we're continuing
the ping pong music tradition over here. It's gonna become like maybe it'll become like a folk thing, you know, like in hundreds of years time they'll talk about, you know, the correlation between like ping pong and certain like rhythms and polyrhythms and things. And,
yeah, I like the idea of that. It's like a translatable skill or something. Yeah. But and then we also saw you like involved in like online life drawing. Like how does that work? Is that like literally just getting something on webcam and drawing it in out in nature or something? Or
no, and so it's, well, the one that I do is my friend, a very old friend of mine called Dave Hederman, and he's an artist and he lives in Berlin. We went to school together in Dublin. Mm. But it just works that a life drawing model just stands there naked and moves into different positions, and everybody, it's usually the same people each week, so there's kind of a bit of a community vibe, but you can see everybody on the Zoom screen or whatever. And
interesting.
What's interesting about it is that every, you know, unlike a in real life life drawing class, everybody's drawing is from the same perspective, obviously, because it's all on the same camera.
True. Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's very interesting to see the variations of how people have interpreted the body, you know. It's cool. It's a really interesting thing to do.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, because I've seen you've thrown up a couple of drawings on Instagram and stuff, and yeah, obviously you've like got a real talent there. I can only really draw like Homer Simpson. That was sort of the extent of my drawing abilities.
It's always your go-to.
Any chance, any time there's a bit of condensation, I'm straight in with that. But but yeah. We had a Elvis impersonator on a few weeks ago, and it got me thinking about the Big Little Lies scene where your voice is sort of overdubbed on Adam Scott, because I don't know if you saw it, but there's like loads of articles like saying, oh, was Adam Scott really singing in Big Little Lies, and there's all this stuff out there. And my girlfriend...
What an angelic voice. Oh, my God.
Exactly. It's weird because my girlfriend was watching it, and obviously, like, we're fans of yours, so we really know it's your voice. And it was just, like, an odd thing, because it was like, is that Minaj's voice, or is that Adam Scott? But, yeah, I presume, did you get, like, lots of messages, or did you know, like, that was happening and that was the deal?
Yeah, well, yeah, pretty much. I got kind of quite a few messages similar to what you just said there of, you know, people that I knew kind of instantly clocking it. And just a lot of people finding it absolutely hilarious. and well, I actually recorded it. I think I was lip syncing to that scene, and I think I had the video and I was lip syncing, or maybe it was the other way around. I can't remember. We did a couple of things, but I did it in the house I was living in at the time. So if you listen very closely, you can hear my, my housemates doing the dishes in the background and stuff.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. I was thinking that maybe you're like forever destined to be Adam Scott's singing voice whenever like he's singing in a film. You know, like in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you got like the Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio situation with the stunt double. That might be
permanent singing double.
Yeah. Yeah, might just be cool.
Or his hand model or something. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, me and Neil, we've been listening to Field of Dreams, like proper loving the album. So congratulations, first of all.
Oh, thank you.
Proper enjoying
Cheers.
It. And I think like a lot of musicians in the pandemic, you know, from reading your bio, it seemed a lot of the, you know, production was done at home. We spoke to a few musicians in like the past year who had to deal with sort of like noise complaints from neighbors. So we spoke to a guy from Las Vegas, and you remember Neil Crispeo from Vampire Weekend was talking about he'd learning how to play the Seinfeld slap bass line and was like driving his wife nuts. But yeah. What's your like neighbor situation? Are you sort of on good terms or like with your housemates?
Yeah, no, good. The neighbor situation is pretty great, actually. Well, there's been a few moments, but mostly pretty good. I got one of those weird sort of mutes that you can get for the trumpet, which you can plug headphones into, so it barely makes a sound in real life. So I think I'm being a good neighbor in that regard. But we've had one or two call overs. When I had my friend Cormac over when he was just starting to learn saxophone. He wanted to just jam trumpet and saxophone, so it was just this cacophony of like the sound of cats dying coming from my apartment.
God, yeah.
And it was just one of those things where a neighbor just opens the door and doesn't have to say anything. They just look at you and just like, no, it's not happening.
Oh, jeez. But it seems like you're in quite a unique situation last year, because I guess you had recorded a bunch of stuff prior to lockdown, and it's almost like you had something quite sacred in recordings where it's like actual people playing music in a room together. Was that sort of how it went? It was sort of like really close to lockdown where you had to pack up.
Well, that was the plan for me, to make an album which was fully the sound of a band in a room playing at the same time. And for the most part, we captured that. Just got there in the nick of time with all of the full band recordings, and then lockdown happened. And I think we probably would have gone back for a couple more full band sessions. So it did sort of change the album in that regard. But I sort of like the mixture of like that energy that you can only get from people in a room playing together, and then sort of this extra sort of weird layer of attention to detail, which kind of runs throughout. I think it was it was definitely a blessing for me, because it was a project to have
Yeah,
when
of
you
course.
Couldn't, you know, really leave your city or whatever. So yeah, it's a bit of a mishmash.
Yeah, really. Definitely.
Yeah, and no, I think you definitely accomplished that because I think it's it sounds like a very good live album. I'm already really looking forward to hearing a lot of the songs live. I could just picture you guys playing it very well. Whereas a lot of these albums, like we're talking about Hotel Tranquility of Arctic Monkeys and stuff before a couple of weeks ago, they're quite hard to transition to the live audience. But I'm looking forward to hearing this live, to be honest.
Yeah,
that's great to hear. It's always a struggle, actually, I find with writing, to sort of always keep one part of your brain into the live arena and just remember that it needs to work on that visceral level, you know. So yeah. I'm glad to hear it sort of doing that for you.
Yeah, definitely. I think, and you mentioned you wanted like the live recordings to really be a part of that. How did you come to that decision? Because I guess would that have been a relatively new thing for you? Because I'm always interested in like the evolution of records, and obviously like this is your fifth studio album, so I assume like you get to the end of, you know, your last record and you probably think about the things you want to keep and things you want to leave behind and go next. But how did you come to that decision where you wanted it to be live, and you know, how did you want to evolve the sounds?
It's always just very natural. Like I think the only rule I've learned in the last sort of 10 years is that the more you start to impose something, the less successful it is, kind of, and so I've tried to just kind of go with the flow. And with this record, it was like I had toured maybe a couple, 2 or 3 years with the same exact group of musicians, maybe with a few fluctuations in between.
Yeah,
and it just there was no question not to use them, you know, and they were kind of, there were sort, a couple of the players were sort of acting as like producers and sort of kicking me up the ass a little bit and kind of like making me realize when I'm being too precious and making me realize when I'm not being precious enough. And it was just sort of really, really fun, you know. It's always just really cool fun to jam, to rock out a jam with your, with your buddies.
Definitely. Cause I mean, you strike me as a guy who sort of does everything pretty much in isolation anyway. Would that be true to say, as in, I know a lot of your records you've was sort of produced and written everything. But I guess, is it having the company on this record just sort of gives, I don't know, an energy to bounce off of or something? Or did you find something new within that?
Yeah, I think it's finding, it's the art of balance and trying to make sure that when you're writing the words and when you're maybe being slightly more thematic about it, for me, I have to be alone. That has to be something where I close the door and I lose track of time when I'm in that zone. And it's something I've been kind of addicted to since I was about the age of 12, I think, where I can just disappear and just sort of make weird little songs. And it doesn't really matter how long it takes, as long as they get to the place they need to be, you know. And that's something that I don't think I'll ever have to worry about that kind of aspect going away. But I kind of need to, you know, keep an eye on it as well, because it's kind of, well, it's not always mentally very, it's not helpful to the rest of my life quite often. Sometimes if I just get too deep into something. So this is a really nice way of kind of bringing it back into the world and making it a social thing. And, you know,
With Fever Dreams in particular, how was the writing process? Do you have a lot of the kind of lyrics that you're constantly writing and then you're trying to fit melodies around that? Or is it that you've had a few like kind of melodies in your head and you're just trying to fit it to the lyrics, or how's your writing process?
I think both of those things and all of it, and like voice memos on your phone, which you can't remember singing at all, you know, and just lots of weird. I think for me, it's just about recording everything and like whether that's with a pencil or with a phone or whatever, and just having scraps of stuff everywhere and then having the discipline to kind of figure out what the links are kind of subconsciously between all those scraps, and then a song starts kind of forming, you know. But discipline is a big one for me, and it's not really something that's ever emphasized too much in sort of, I guess, in musical interviews or whatever, but for me, I was listening to lots of Duke Ellington, and I didn't make a Duke Ellington album, but it sounded to me, it was like I can just hear the discipline that he had, and that his writer Billy Strayhorn had, and all these people who were just like really focused on trying to put like some sort of pattern, some sort of like structure onto onto something which could be much looser and still work or whatever. I'm quite into that, you know. Imposing structures at certain moments and then letting it be free flow in other moments. You know, it's kind of an important thing, I think, for art.
Did you, with the circumstances of lockdown, did you ever get any moments where you were driving yourself a bit crazy? Because I know a lot of us probably went a bit loopy throughout lockdown just purely through working and everything like that. But obviously, I guess for, you know, music, you don't really have a time where you have to clock out. You could be up until like 6 a.m. if you wanted to.
Yeah, well, I used to be like, I'm not really like that anymore. I tend to try and wake up with the sun, try and be, you know, a normal person. But I don't know. It was that I've had so many phases of the lockdown now, and my living situation's always in flux, and everything's always. I just kind of tried to kind of keep some sort of balance in, you know, the work life routine, and I've got kind of a nice bubble group of friends that I tend to sort of be able to see, and one of the couples I know very well had a baby around the time, and that was quite a nice focus for all of us. It's almost like we became a little family for a while.
Oh, amazing.
I was kind of weird uncle dancing around the background with a trumpet.
Amazing.
But
so discipline starting to come into your like everyday life as well, not just music, trying to just live by normal times. And
I guess it's that, I think Nick Cave made that quite famous, didn't he, when he said he likes to write 9 to 5 kind of thing, you know. And then I think there's lots of value in that, you know, and it sort of dispels that myth of the crazy artist separate from society. And I don't think that's helpful. I think it's just work regardless, you know. And if you put the hours in, it's sort of, you'll get good results kind of thing.
Yeah, Nick Cave's got a funny system actually. Cause I think he says he's always dressed in a suit as well, isn't he? So it's like puts his suit on, has a little briefcase or something, goes down, works 9 to 5, and then comes back, which sounds like I think Damon Albarn does the same thing. Yeah, exactly. It is really interesting. You mentioned Duke Ellington there. I was wondering, have you got like a recommendation for like an introduction to Duke Ellington, or where you could start with that world?
Yeah. Well, the one that I'm most obsessed with is an album called Masterpieces, which he humbly called Masterpieces, which is his. I think it's one of the first jazz records which made use of the extra time available on vinyl long players.
Right, yeah.
So he extended 4 of his famous showband tunes so that they were much longer, and added lots of really amazing, weird arrangement changes to them.
Amazing.
And this would be like 1950. So this is like, you know, more than a decade after his initial kind of big band buzz or whatever. So he was kind of, it was almost like a comeback album kind of thing.
And
it's really amazing. It's called Masterpieces. So definitely recommend that.
Nice one.
And then there's a couple of live albums, which are, there's one at a Newport Jazz Festival, which again is much later in his career. And it was seen as another kind of comeback moment in his career. And it's so punk. It's just like, they're all just like, amazing jazz players, but they're really hitting the drums and they're really going for it. And when they try and leave the stage, there's uproar from the audience, and you can just hear this incredible energy in the recordings.
Oh, amazing.
I definitely recommend those two albums for sure.
And there's a guy you mentioned as well. I think you said it was like his one of his backup players, and he was quite an interesting figure. I can't remember what his name was. I think you mentioned it earlier.
Yeah, he was a guy called Billy Strayhorn. Very interesting guy. He was openly gay, and would have been like, he would have known Martin Luther King as well, and that he would have walked with him, and he would have done that. Duke kind of took him under his wing when he met him backstage, and he gave him his address because Billy Strayhorn was much younger than him, and he told him that he was writing music. So Duke gave him his address and told him to visit him.
Wow.
And he said take the A train to get to my house. And then when he turned up at his house, he had written a song called Take the A Train, which became one of Duke's most famous most famous pieces.
That's crazy.
Pretty cool.
That's cool. It's I've definitely got to dive into that world a bit more and find out more about these, because there's always these people on the side that have like such interesting stories, as interesting as the people in front of the mic and everything. But definitely got to check that
totally,
out.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
I was wondering about the concepts of the Fever Dreams record as well, because I think what's really great is throughout the record you have these voices coming in at different levels and these really stark changes, and it sort of feels like, I don't know, you know, when you're a bit hungover or you're a bit worse for wear, and you like for some reason like a noise will just come in at a completely different frequency to something else, and it sort of startles you a bit. But because so obviously that hangs heavy on the album, but I was just wondering what it was about that concept that you wanted to try and replicate through Sonics and maybe through the lyrics as well.
I kind of liked the idea of it being, I think throughout the album there's a little bit of a theme of lo-fi and hi-fi kind of clashing, you know. There's moments when it was kind of linking it to scale for me, so the idea of, you know, a couple of the tunes kind of they feel like they're quite intimate at certain moments, and then you suddenly realize you're kind of looking into the universe and into space and stuff and the vastness of everything. And I just wanted to represent that sensation of those moments when you hit upon those incredible moments of realization that you're just this tiny, tiny thing in this gigantic universe. And I think I was trying to use layering, and there's quite a few moments of whispering and talking just being added as samples, and that came from lots of different sources. There was a couple where I asked some villagers fans to send in whispers.
Oh, that's cool.
Saying "the more I know, the more I care," which was the original album title. And there's a couple of other things. But yeah, it all gives it that sort of weird, I guess, slightly hungover vibe, as you said.
Yeah.
I have, I'd say a quarter of it might have been slightly hungover anyway.
I always feel like there's a productive side to a hangover as well, because I think, like, because your thoughts are in a different way. And I haven't been hungover so much in the past year. Me and Neil were away for a weekend last week, so we were really hungover on, like, Monday and Tuesday. But there's something... I was even out with a few friends and we were all hungover recently, and you know, you just have different conversations. Like, it's not the same as when you're, I don't know, drinking or whatever. I quite miss that.
You don't expect as much as of yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, true.
You don't expect. So
you lose that filter as well.
Exactly. Yeah. It's sort of, those like surprising frequencies stuff reminded me of whenever I listened to I Saw the Deads on your first record. The bit where it sounds like a mic has fallen over never fails to like scare the shit out of me whenever I'm like I'm listening to it, because we were listening back to it because we got your like 10th anniversary version of the record and stuff, and I just forgot that it was there, so it was definitely a surprise to my heart when that fell in again.
From I think that's the sound of the door of the studio being slammed.
Oh, no way.
And I think it was about the 7th take. We were trying to get the best possible slam. And it was in Tommy's parents' house. So I think after that take, his dad was just like, shut the fuck up.
Another neighbour sort of debacle again. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting you were talking about the more I know, the more I care thing that sort of pops up quite a few times throughout the record. And I saw you speaking about stripping songs back to, you know, be really simple and, you know, really get to, I don't know, boil it down to the roots of what the song is, which I find really interesting. And I don't know, it made me think of like the way Nick Cave writes, actually. I don't know if you read his Red Hand files, but his language is, you know, it's not really, it's not like sort of flowery language at all. He sort of writes in quite a straightforward way, but still manages to amaze you. But I was wondering, yeah, what made you want to do that? Is it just from reading and enjoying other songwriters? Because it always seems like when you can boil it down to its like parts or something really simple, that's where it can really be a striking thing.
Yeah, I think sometimes it can be a little bit of a cop-out to write intentionally obscure words, because it can be quite easy to sound deep, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of early poetry does that, or a lot of, definitely a lot of the stuff that I tried when I was a teenager was sort of that, you know, trying to use longer words or trying to, and which is probably good at that time because you're learning those words and you're trying to get better at language and stuff. But I do think there's a huge value in constantly simplifying. Mm. And a lot of what I did on this record was just strip away a lot of the words that were in there. So Simpatico was a song that had a lot more verses and a lot of, it didn't quite know what it was for a long time. And I nearly threw it out. And then my drummer at the time just told me not to. And he said, there's definitely something there.
Yeah.
And so we actually just ended up jamming it together as a band, and I was just mumbling stuff. And then I, you know, brought it back to my home studio and then realized it actually hardly needs anything. It's all there, you know. It's just, you have to have faith in the fact that there's a core to what you're doing, you know.
Yeah.
And then it very quickly wrote itself. It was just this very easy song after that, but only after the previous few steps of, you know, missteps all over the place, and eventually it just kind of rolls down the hill.
Yeah,
you know?
It's interesting how you can get from A to B sometime as well. Because I think I remember around Awayland, you were talking about you were experimenting with a lot of electronic stuff, and you're making these big like 12-minute songs. And you eventually got to something that was, you know, still using an acoustic guitar and stuff. But you wouldn't have got there had you not have done that big, you know, gone on that leap into the electronic world and come back. But it's always interesting how you can get from A to B and sort of surprise yourself.
Yeah, I actually found some of the demos from Awayland recently, actually. There's some really weird versions that Nothing Arrived, which is now sort of like this song that we just play at almost every show because the most people know it now for some reason. Yeah. But it's just the final version that's popular now is a really solo, just me and acoustic guitar, and then we just add a touch of, you know, synths or whatever, just very, very subtle stuff. Mm. But I found a version the other day which had just 10 million chords and had like all these weird drum machines all over it, and it had like this kind of elf kind of voice in the background going like, it's just stuff that just would not have, you know, had legs at all. But I think maybe in the process of doing that, there was an extra line written, and then that line made its way back into the song. It's a funny, weird experience sometimes, you know. And then there's the other songs that just come out, and there's a song on the new record which is called Momentarily, and I think I barely rewrote anything on it. We just played it as a band, and that's the version on the album, you know. So there's never really any hard and fast rules, you know.
What's mysterious?
Equally, do you ever listen to old demos and think the opposite? In fact, like, not regretting anything, but thinking, oh, I wish I did include that little segment here in this song. Or,
oh, definitely, yeah definitely. Quite often, yeah. And it's something you can do live. You can re-import stuff live, you know.
Yeah, true.
Oh, let's put that into it now, and then it kind of changes the song again. And so, it's the fun thing about music.
Is there any songs that do that really simple, you know, approach to songwriting really well for you? Is there anything that you listen to that really boils it down to its parts and just sort of speaks to what it's actually trying to say?
You mean, like that you can sort of instantly feel what the song's about and there's not really many filters and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, it's such an obvious reference, but the first thing that comes to mind is the way Dylan can write these really complicated tunes, but then he can also just do like a Christmas album, and it's just about Santa or something, or, you know, he can just do these, and it sort of works because the intent, you can hear the intent in what he's doing, you know, and that kind of the purity of expression there. But yeah, I don't know. There's also just like really great, I guess, great Motown songs and just great, like, great love songs. Very simple.
Yeah.
But a lot of, I mean, also a lot of what I was getting into for this album was instrumental music. So obviously you can kind of impart your own emotions and ideas and themes onto music with no words a lot more. And I find that quite interesting, especially like with, I really dig kind of like library music from the late 60s and early 70s and stuff that was just when analog recording was at its peak and the players were always really good and they were just constantly trying to test the boundaries of like where they could take arrangements and music and I kind of dig that at the moment as well, just that idea of like something quite far away from the idea of a perfect pop song, just a perfect kind of instrumental arrangement, you know. And that was really influencing me for this record too, you know, trying to remember that there are certain songs you don't need to add narratives to. It can just be expressing a sensation, or it can just be expressing like 2 seconds in time, you know, which you stretch out into 4 minutes through the use of music and, you know, playing with time and space and all that kind of stuff.
I can kind of see that as well, going back to the how I hear it. I can imagine hearing it live. There'll be a lot of instances, I can imagine, even at the end of Circles and the Firing Line, where you got that cool solo. I can imagine there's a lot more jamming involved, which you'll have a lot of fun with doing this live as well.
Totally, yeah. We're really rocking that one out at the moment in rehearsals, trying to see how far we can take it.
Nice.
I was also wondering about, because you've been doing this book club online and you appear very well read, but I saw like a few years ago you were talking about the fact that you were distracted by your phone so much at one point that you just weren't reading any books, and I'm sort of in that rut at the minute as well. So I really want to try, you know, reading more, but for some reason I just like can't get into it. But have you got any was that like something you had to work on to try and switch off, and do you have any tips for
I actually think the lockdown was great for me for that, because like I'm the same as you. I'm still checking my phone all the time. I'm not like, I haven't been cured of that particular religion. I've heard this from quite a few people I know as well, where you know, as soon as society kind of suddenly broke down for a while, it sort of makes you reassert what's important to you. And and for me that was kind of understanding that like what your brain gets out of reading long form literature and reading things that require a little bit more effort and work, you know. And it's kind of helped my writing a lot as well. And but it is a constant battle. I mean, we're in a weird age, I think, psychologically. And I think I'm probably a bit older than you guys, and like I just feel like when I hang around with people 10 years younger than me, I can see the difference in how we interact with technology. And there's both positives and negatives to that, I think, in the age groups. But it's just trying to kind of really maintain a, you know, an idea of what the context is every morning when you wake up. Why am I checking this thing? What is this thing doing to me? Am I being programmed? Is this what's going on here? And then and then reading books that were written before the internet ever existed and seeing this insane level of articulacy and incredible use of language, which still exists obviously in books, in some books, but I do think there's a sort of a little bit of a de-intellectualization of mainstream culture at the moment because of the internet and because of the way the internet is maybe monetizing so-called content or whatever.
Definitely. It's weird. It made me think of the, I don't know if you've read it, but the book Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman.
I've read about that book, but I haven't read it.
It's definitely worth checking out. It's quite a short read as well, but at one point he talks about the fact that people used to go to these presidential debates and they'd be able to almost like reel off exactly what Abraham Lincoln was saying, but they'd be able to sort of take it in and then go away and say it to friends, and they'd be able to, you know, talk for like 2 minutes about what they actually spoke about. Whereas now you just get these little nuggets of information, and then it's always the memory is in your phone, really, as in you can just look at it any time. So it's a weird thing for memory as well. And just like you say, being able to comprehend it is way different now, I think.
Yeah, I think it has quite far-reaching ramifications as well. I like just what you said there about the American side of things. I've been watching recently this old discussion program called The Firing Line with William F. Buckley Jr. There's a whole YouTube. Mm. Someone's put them all up on YouTube. And he would have been a very conservative, probably right-wing commentator in American politics back in the sort of 50s, 60s, 70s. No, probably 60s and 70s, maybe. Mm. 50s, 60s, 70s. But I wouldn't agree with him on a lot of things, but what I find interesting about it is that he gets people in on the complete opposite side of the spectrum on so many issues,
right.
and has an extremely detailed and respectful debate with them. And I just don't know if we're seeing that as much at the moment. I think a lot of people are throwing stones and a lot of people are sort of being a bit more tribalistic rather than actually getting involved in proper discussion, respectful discussion, and understanding why someone else might have a different opinion and all this. I think that might be the internet to blame a little bit. And I think that art and culture and literature, like the history of literature is all about how messy we are as human beings, And that's what art should be about. It should be about respecting the fact that you're never going to be perfect. No one is perfect. And your opinion might change it. And it's important to remember the fallibility of us, I guess, as humans.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's totally, you nailed it on the head there. I feel like there's, in current day of age, this whole internet age and social media, there's a lot less openness to other opinions like that. The amount of times when we've been in like political debates in this country, and even like American friends of mine, I've seen people put their statuses up being like, if you're a whatever fan, just delete me as like a friend on Facebook. It's like, but then with all the personalization of these social media channels, they're all pushing you to only read the same stuff that you're interested in. So you get, you're only talking to people who have the same views, the same idealization, and just, so you're just getting pushed down this narrow kind of tunnel vision, which is, like you say, internet is to blame for that. Whereas hearing varied opinions is important, like respectfully as well, like you said.
Yeah.
It's a proper mess, isn't it?
Mm.
But I was also wondering about the. I know you spoke about a book, the George Orwell one on writing, and I saw your note about the sort of early writer's development, and I was wondering whether that's something that you saw in yourself. I think you mentioned about creating this private world to begin with, and then you got the imitation, wearing your influence on your sleeve, and then was it about folding it in and honouring those impulses? So is that something that resonated with yourself, like maybe when you look back at early Villagers' work or even like your stuff with The Immediate?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I was writing on par with Orwell back then. But I think the main thing I got out of that particular essay was the fact that, so many people would associate him with somebody who challenged authoritarianism and totalitarianism but he's sort of very quick to sort of say, well, hang on, but I'm writing from a biased perspective, and you have to know that as well as you're reading it, and you have to be an intelligent reader, and I'm not writing a Bible here, and he's also sort of, again, he's sort of saying, I'm an emotional human being and I've got contradictions within me and I change my mind. And a lot of this stuff, is in my writing as well. I just find that kind of humbling. And again, something that we should hear more these days, I think, instead of needing to brand yourself very early on or of a certain, on whatever issue, whatever. I'm quite inspired by that, it's the messiness, the messiness of our humanity. And you can see it in his, the thing about Orwell as well is that he was kind of a polymath in a weird way. Like he would write about political issues, but then he would sort of, some of the passages that he'd write are really poetically written too, and I love that when writers are able to do kind of mix and match artistic kind of methods and not really have to draw a distinction between them, like the aesthetic mixed with the message. That can all be one thing in certain expressions, you know. And I think that's, you know, that's a pretty cool thing to keep in mind.
Yeah, definitely. It was weird. I was looking at some stuff around The Immediate, which was obviously your band before Villages. Now, I don't know if this is Wikipedia folklore or whatever, but there's a bit on the Wikipedia page where it says about a CD was thrown on stage at Manic Street Preachers gig and someone slipped a CD into Beck's bag in a Dublin bookstore. Store. So I was wondering, was that you or was that like another member of the band who did that?
I threw the cassette tape at Nicky Wire. I'll say that in a court of law. I love the fact it was a cassette tape as well. Maybe it was a CD. I don't know if I'm that.
Yeah. I feel like CD could do more damage.
Yeah.
How did it go down?
Well, I have a very vivid memory of it. It was in a place that was called The Point in Dublin, but now it's the O2 Arena, or maybe it's the 3 Arena. No, I can't remember which one, but
yeah.
And I threw it on stage and I just have this memory of him like picking up the bag and just like, what the hell is this? And then just like throwing it to one of the roadies. And I was just like, I'm famous. I'm going to be on whatever. I'll be on TV tomorrow. Nicky Wire has my demo.
Oh, amazing.
But it was actually, it was a lovely, like, I actually told him that a few years later. Well, quite a few years later. I met him at a BBC thing and he actually came up to me and he said, "Oh, I really like Nothing Arrived because Nothing Arrived had just come out."
Yeah.
It's like, I once threw a CD at you. and it was quite a funny moment.
Yeah. Amazing. I was wondering if you had any tips on slipping demo tapes to influential people. Or if that's actually happened to you, has anybody ever like slipped you a tape or anything?
Oh yeah, definitely. Like after shows and stuff. It's really cool. Like, although it's usually CDs, and I have no way of playing CDs at all anymore, so I don't know unless I'm in a car.
Yeah.
But I guess just be respectful, and you know, usually people like getting gifts, and that's kind of a nice thing.
I'm currently living with my parents right now with my girlfriend, and come to realize the fact that they hate silence, like they always have to be talking. And I was sort of recalling some of your gigs or around the Wayland or whenever you play intimate songs. This really is, the whole room goes quiet and you can't really hear. There's like not a pin drop. I was wondering, did it take a bit of time to get used to that? Because it must be quite bizarre having everybody just listening to your every, you know, every sort of finger pick, and whether you've ever been thrown off. Because I was at a Laura Marling gig once, and it's one of those moments, you know, everybody was totally silent and somebody like scraped a chair and it just totally like blew the mood, and like she started laughing and stuff. But I was wondering, like, did it take a while to get used to that, and whether anything like that's happened and it's like totally thrown you off?
It didn't happen for a long time, so it was kind of nice when it started to happen, because I, some of the songs that I write work better quiet, you know, they just do. There was a very early show actually that we did in Dublin before that started happening, and it was kind of a showcase, kind of an important gig for Villages. And I think Domino were at it, I think a couple of labels were at it and everything, and I was a bit nervous, and the audience was just like chatting away super loud, like drinking beer, just like chatting as loud as they could over everything I was doing. And I just, in the middle of it, just went, because I looked about 12 back then as well. So I had this, like, I used to cut my own hair with, like, I had a bowl haircut, and I was probably like 25 or 26, but I still looked like very young and sort of timid, you know. And in the middle of the show, I was playing a really quiet song, and then I just went, "Shut the fuck up!" Like screaming at them, and sort of half the audience kind of shut up, and the other half just went, started booing me. And this was like our first big kind of showcase, it made the rest of the show a little bit better. And then we got, like, all the press about the show was just about that one moment, so I got this kind of reputation for a while around Dublin as someone, you know, don't mess with that guy. But I don't know, like, it's Yeah, it just feels, it feels like, it feels nice when it's at the right moment. Like, hopefully we're doing Latitude this month, and we just finished rehearsing for that, and obviously that's more of a festival set, but there's still a couple of little kind of quiet moments, so I'm interested to see if that'll, you know, translate to the tent and stuff, because sometimes that can still work a little bit in festivals, you know. So looking forward to that, you know.
And you've been like whipping out the flugelhorn at a lot of live shows in the last one as well, which is,
I've kind of dumped the flugelhorn. I've just replaced it with a normal trumpet now, so it's a little bit more versatile. I don't really know why I started on a flugelhorn. I just like the name, I think.
Yeah, it's a fun word to say for sure.
Yeah. Trumpets are more, they're just more versatile, so I'm jamming that at the moment.
We got the Becoming a Jackal 10th anniversary edition, and I was wondering, like, how do you find looking back at, you know, your really early work? Do you have like a good relationship with it, or do you ever hear stuff and you're like, oh, I want to change it? Because I assume you'd have to have done some listening back around that time you were maybe putting together that package.
Yeah, I mean, it's the main thing that hit me was just how much work went into those songs, and I can see sort of a parallel with this new album and that very first one, because lockdown kind of made me really, really work hard on the songs again, and I perhaps wasn't as busy as I would have been. There's moments I often find with a lot of the early recordings, my voice sounds deeper, and I find that really confusing. I think I was putting on a different character or something, and it was a different kind of buzz. And also, I think I also find when you're doing like lots of interviews over a decade, you start getting fake memories about stuff because you've been almost told constantly, you know, based on whatever the press release is at the time, the same fact. And eventually, as you answer that question, that fact keeps changing in your mind, you know? So sometimes when I listen back to the original recordings, the actual truth of the thing comes back to me. It's a very strange, strange experience.
But, yeah. No, I bet. Because, we don't often get the opportunity to look back. I think unless you're a musician, you probably wouldn't get the opportunity to look back on work if you're, I don't know, if you've got a regular job or whatever. I sort of look back at, I was telling Neil recently, I wrote a few songs at university and I look back on them and they were just like terrible, really bad. But
I told you then that they were terrible, so you didn't listen.
I didn't listen, no. But the encouragement we love
you
to
waste,
see.
You wasted all that time.
Yeah, he can write some right shit, this guy.
I'm sure it's not too bad, Sean.
Oh, thanks, man.
Don't listen to Neil there.
I know, it's sort of a negativity I have to put up with. But
I know. We were just talking when we were doing the intro before you came on, just about kind of when we pick up guitars, what's the first song we play? For me, it's almost a check if I'm in tune. I always play the Smiths, Please Let Me Get What I Want. Sean's go-to is always Courage by Yourself. So I've heard about 20 times in the last week when we were away with each other. But I was wondering if you've got a go-to song when you pick up a guitar, if it's not your own.
I usually go to stuff that I would have been learning when I was sort of getting better at the guitar. So it's usually Radiohead or something like that. It's usually like something from the Bends or OK Computer.
Yeah.
And if it's not that, it might be... what else would I play? Maybe like Norwegian Wood or something by the Beatles. Nice. Or maybe Wonderwall.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Connor. I really appreciate it. Me and Neil and our other half are going to come see you in Manchester, hopefully, if the COVID sort of stays off of it. But yeah, really looking forward to seeing that gig, man. And
great.
Yeah,
and
me too.
Congrats on this album. Like, best of luck with it. It's a great piece of work. So
thanks so much. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
No worries.
Thank you.
So Neil, as Villagers fans, that was a fantastic chat, I think.
Yeah,
Lots of little nuggets of information over the years. I quite like the Nicky Wire attack as well.
I hope you didn't get a sharp edge in there. But
what we do as well is we'll chuck in some of the music Connor mentioned as well. He spoke about Duke Ellington, so definitely make sure that's in there. And also, I know we spoke a little bit about earlier some of the covers and everything, and so I'll drop a few of those in there too. And obviously a link to his album, which will be out on August the 20th. So another good ep, Neil. People can follow us on MOT Pod on Instagram and Twitter. And yeah, give us a subscribe and a 5-star to you if you enjoyed it. And Neil, as always, an absolute bloody pleasure, mate.
Yeah, no, really, really good episode. Really enjoyed that. But yeah, I've got to hop off anyway now, mate, because I was busy. See you later.
I'm definitely going to put some reverb on that.